America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. As a society, we've seen how complex it is to bounce back from a pandemic. Can you imagine the public health effects of a war, even when it arrives at our doorstep affecting a limited number of people like the 9/11 responders or those who served in Iraq and Afghanistan and suffered the long-term hazards from burn pits? Consider the effects on the whole of the population of, say, Ukraine, trying to conduct everyday life with health hazards those of us who've never faced combat on our soil would consider unthinkable. We discuss the effects of war on the average citizen in war zones today. That's all here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Dr. Barry Levy. And he's written a very important book, particularly at this moment in time, Horror to Hope, Recognizing and Preventing the Health Impacts of War. And I've got to tell you, Dr. Levy, when I first read the subtitle to the book, I said, wait a minute, how do we prevent the health impacts of war? It's all about destroying people's health and well-being. And of course, as you go on, you do clarify that to help us understand that there are reasons to be hopeful. But then again, as we watch what's going on in Ukraine today, we recognize how profoundly impacting war is, not only on the soldiers, but clearly on the civilians as well.
Good to be with you today, Larry, and with your listeners. War has a profound effect on civilians in many, many ways. It's a subject that doesn't get discussed as much as it should. I mean, it, obviously, with the war going on in Ukraine, there's more and more attention to this issue. You know, there are many other wars going on in the world. There's something like 40 wars going on, many of them in distant places that never make the news media or social media in the United States. The war in Ukraine is really raising our awareness of the impact on civilians.
It's very interesting because I recall just a couple of months ago at the beginning of the conflict, I was thinking about it as a pitched battle between armies. And of course, the Russians with their tactics reminded us so clearly, profoundly, and disturbingly about the impacts on civilians. But I hadn't really thought about how much civilians are now used as various tools toward subjugation during war. And in fact, it's not about standing armies anymore. Even our conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan emphasize that.
Yes, indeed. And targeting of civilians and civilian infrastructure, that is, you know, hospitals, schools, shopping centers, food and water distribution networks. This has become a strategy of war, not only in the war in Ukraine, but in many other wars, unfortunately, over the last couple of decades.
At the outset, you asked why, given the physical and the psychological trauma inflicted by war, why organizations that are set up to avoid this in the modern era, no less, like the United Nations, and in many ways, the policemen of the world, the United States, trying generally to keep the peace, hasn't intervened. What is the world perhaps saying by virtue of the fact that there are some limits in what many countries, I mean the majority of countries in a vast sense, really want to happen but can't affect?
Yeah, well, I mean, the prevention of war and promotion of peace is difficult. And while we're focusing appropriately on the war in Ukraine and some other wars as well, we also need to focus on some of the success stories that have occurred in a number of years that have actually prevented wars. I mean, when war is prevented, just like when an epidemic is prevented or a fire is prevented, it doesn't make the headlines. But the quiet work that goes on, year in, year out to prevent war, by improving governance, improving the education and health of peoples, enabling people to be more engaged in the decisions of their governments and so forth. Those success stories, unfortunately, don't make the headlines as often as they do. Now we have failed in many ways because there are so many wars in the world, including the war in Ukraine. You know, it's difficult to prevent war, particularly when a ruler like Vladimir Putin decides to conduct a war of aggression against another country.
You remind us that today most wars are civil wars that are anything but civil in Ethiopia, Yemen, South Sudan. The wars aren't civil for civilians. And I just want to remind people what happens to a civil society as this destruction is going on throughout. I mean, you talk about infrastructure ruined, schools, roads, hospitals. We're looking now at a figure in Ukraine of $750 billion is estimated to rebuild the country. We look at water, the environment. I mean, help us understand, because you have been there. Explain that to the audience, where you have been in these hot zones. But explain what you think takes the longest time to recover.
Well, you're right. It's a total destruction of society, and it's not only the financial cost and the economic impact, but the human cost. You know, we talk often about statistics, and statistics, a good friend and colleague of mine for many years used to say that statistics are people with the tears removed. And so it's hard to grasp the enormity of the impact on civilian lives that occurs as a result of war. There are reported by the UN in the range of several thousand deaths. Indeed, there might be tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of deaths in Ukraine at present time. And there's something that occurs called psychic numbing. You know, when the numbers become so large, we cannot, as humans, grasp the impact on other humans of the carnage that's taking place. It's not only the pictures we see on television, for example, of the bombing and the people killed and the apartment complexes and shopping centers destroyed and so forth, but it's the destruction of the infrastructure. It's how food is used as a weapon, and food is restricted, and so people cannot get access to food or to clean water. The clinics and hospitals are targeted. So not only are doctors and their patients killed and injured, but those health services are shut down, and so people can't get basic medical care. And so even people who have heart disease or diabetes end up dying because they can't get their basic medications. People develop diseases because the water supply is contaminated and they get cholera or other diseases. People are displaced and they're crowded into shelters where diseases like COVID or even tuberculosis can spread so much more easily. So there are a lot of not only immediate direct effects of the war that are easily seen, but the indirect effects on people's lives. They can't get safe food and water. They can't get medical care. They can't go to work. They can't go to school. And the profound social and mental health effects go on not only during the course of the war, but perhaps for the entirety of these people's lives who are affected.
Oh, absolutely. And you talk about that. And we need to think about that, because to start a war is to start such a chain of events that are so unforeseen in terms of their potential impacts. For example, and I'm only continuing to talk a lot about Ukraine because it's in the news, but as you say, there are many other conflicts going on. But with Ukraine, the impact on food and politics in places like Africa and around the globe, it reminds me of that old notion of a butterfly flicks its wings half a world away, and then there's an earthquake results. I mean, this is really what's happening around the globe.
Profoundly. And you touched on perhaps the most important thing is the reduction of food exports from Ukraine and possibly even somewhat from Russia as well. But countries that depend on wheat and corn and other crops from Ukraine, which is really the breadbasket of Europe, that has been providing food for many countries, low-income countries in Africa and elsewhere, that shipment of food is now being restricted. Or Russia has actually taken over, stolen that grain and tried to sell it to these same countries, which are in a very difficult bind. Do they buy the grain from Russia, or do they choose not to and subject their own peoples to starvation and hunger? So you're right. The indirect effects of the war are profound. And two or three other indirect effects. One is that it's causing a lot of other countries to kind of rethink their budgets. For example, Germany has decided to double their defense budget, and so that money that otherwise might be going for healthcare or education or the social safety net in Germany is now going for, understandably in some ways, their increased military budget. The other thing that's happening, and again, something that people don't recognize, is that it's really disrupting a lot of international cooperation that goes on that, enables the world to function in so many ways. For example, early detection of pandemic diseases or diseases that could become pandemic really depends on scientists and public health officials in countries throughout the world working cooperatively so that this does not happen. And so, the disruption that's occurred in many ways as a result of this war in Ukraine is really profound.
You tell us that the vast majority of deaths in war in the recent period are from these indirect causes like starvation, water contamination. So I want people to internalize that. We're not talking about directly necessarily from a gunshot or an artillery piece, but you say that the role of health professionals, you're relatively powerless. And of course, you have been the president of the American Public Health Association. So you know well we've been talking a lot about public health during the pandemic. Now we're focused on it for the moment about war. You say that war is a public health catastrophe. Civilians, non-combatants, suffer a large proportion of the deaths in war, though it's hard to put a percentage on it. I mean, can you help us with perhaps that impact and how much relative to even those who are considered combatants?
It's hard to get exact numbers, but in a general sense, if we go back 100 years, the time of World War I, say, the vast majority of deaths during war were, as you say, military deaths, in the range of 80 to 90%. Now that percentage has been flipped. It's hard, again, to get exact numbers, but we are off it for many wars. We're talking about most of the deaths and severe illnesses and injuries being inflicted on civilians, and that's accounting for 80 to 90% of the casualties during war.
And that's the way we fight wars these days, more guerrilla-like. You remind us that most wars going on in the world today are civil wars, not necessarily. Well, of course, between the two superpowers or three superpowers, little of that can go on. And we've been reminded of that because of nuclear weapons. But we use proxies or we have major countries going in as we did in Iraq or Afghanistan or as the Russians are in Ukraine. What does that imbalance do? Because you don't have the two or three superpowers facing off against each other, that alone would destroy the public health of the entire globe.
Yes, well, a couple of things. One is that, as you say, even though there isn't direct involvement by the United States and Russia or China in many wars, at least obvious direct involvement, indeed, the United States and other superpowers are involved indirectly. There's been a war in Yemen where the United States has sided with Saudi Arabia, is at least indirectly responsible for some of the civilian casualties that are occurring as a result of that war. And the same is true with other wars in which Russia or China has played a role in supporting one side or the other. So that's one thing that's happening. The other thing that's happening is that, as you say, most of the wars today are civil wars in distant countries where the United States or Russia or China may not be directly involved, and we do not hold, and in fact, nobody is holding the warring powers accountable for the war crimes that may be committed. And so various actors in these wars, are, be they government forces or rebel groups, are acting with impunity. There is no accountability during or after the war for the war crimes that are being committed. And as you say, the conscious attacks being made, the deliberate attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure.
Well, I know America is suggesting that war crimes are taking place in Ukraine, but does anyone really think that those people responsible are going to be held to account? The book is called From Horror to Hope, Recognizing and Preventing the Health Impacts of War. Dr. Barry Levy is with us. You describe the U.S. in the context of war. I guess it's a very confusing thing. Most Americans would like to think that we're on the side of the angels. However, are we really a promoter of peace when we have been involved in many conflicts and are the world's largest arms dealer? As you point out, we've got a defense budget that is, I think, 11 times larger than or larger than the next 11 countries. So yet we're relatively immune from direct attack given our geography, but we're not afraid to project our might around the world. What do you think is a fair way to describe America's role in trying to maintain peace?
Well, let me emphasize some of the positive things. You know, you're correct in saying that the United States has done some certainly very adverse things in terms of the war and arming countries and so forth. But we've also done a number of very good things to improve the responsiveness of governments to their peoples, to help economic development in many countries, to improve education and employment opportunities for people in many countries. And I think many of these things that are done, you know, quietly and over the long term, really are efforts that reduce the likelihood of war and are likely to promote peace. So, I mean, there are a lot of things we could talk about and we can point fingers in terms of things we've done wrong, but I really would like to emphasize things that we, both as individuals and as nations, can do to help resolve disputes nonviolently, help reduce the root causes of war, and do things to build the infrastructure for peace.
There are so many aspects to this. Let me ask you just a couple quickly. Are totalitarian regimes more brutal in the execution of war than democratic states? Is that fair to say or no?
Well, I think it's hard to generalize, but I even though in the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, starting in 2003 with the shock and awe and so forth, and there were many Iraqis, perhaps as many as 600,000 or more killed during that war, there is a distinction to be made between the U.S. military and the military of Russia. You know, there are the Geneva Conventions and other international law and human rights law that are intended to protect civilians as opposed to combatants during war. And for the most part, the U.S. military is very well trained and for the most part observes those Geneva Conventions during war. I can't say that for the Russians and for other militaries, not only in wars between countries, but wars within countries where civilians have been attacked and militaries have consciously gone after attacking, have attacked civilians and civilian infrastructure. Somebody who did a study of all the civil wars of the last 20 or 30 years found that in roughly half of the civil wars, governments and in half the civil wars, rebel groups committed the worst atrocities against civilians, thinking that they were, unaccountable to anybody. And in fact, you're right. In most situations, almost all the situations, people have gotten away with murder, literally have gotten away with murder. And so, you know, it is in a sense, a very depressing kind of situation.
You remind us that war creates many individual and family tragedies. I think television during the Ukraine situation has focused on a number of those, and we've seen them almost nightly. But it is to children, women, combatants, the elderly, and of course the displaced, the refugees. Let's focus on the children, because you talk about deaths really rising to a greater degree in children under five. And then, of course, we've got these children who are forced into combat situations. So let's focus for a moment on children in conflict.
First of all, children are more vulnerable to infectious diseases like respiratory infections, diarrheal diseases, and other diseases, measles, for example, during war. So children suffer as a result of increased occurrence of communicable diseases. They also suffer because of malnutrition. Food access is restricted. Young children, mothers may be malnourished and may be unable to breastfeed. Children suffer from the mental health effects of war. They see atrocities. Their parents may be injured or killed. They may be displaced. They may see displaced from their homes, their communities. They may be out of school, very likely, as a result. So their lives are turned upside down. Many of them are injured or killed, and they suffer mental health effects that may scar them for their entire lives. So children are profoundly affected during war. And, war has intergenerational effects. When those children grow up, their children are going to be affected by the mental health effects of the wars that these children have suffered. You mentioned child soldiers. That apparently is not an issue in the war in Ukraine, but it is an issue in many other wars. It has been estimated that there are perhaps as many as 250,000 child soldiers in the war who've been forced to pick up arms. Many of these children are orphans who have no other structure in their lives, and they are either kidnapped or strongly coerced into joining the military. So it's a horrendous situation.
I was reading recently where hardware and hardships, U.S. doctors are helping Ukraine medical teams via telehealth, but the needs are staggering. And they were talking about this trauma specialist in a Ukraine city, Dr. Andrei Bukak, and the way that he is relying on American doctors to help him because there are injuries that he is seeing that he has never experienced, nor does he have the equipment to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important part of what's going on in terms of improving the treatment of civilians and to some extent military, the Ukrainian military and others who have been seriously injured during the war. We also need to keep in mind sort of even at a bigger picture, or bigger level, larger level, the impacts on healthcare. There have been direct attacks on healthcare during the war in Ukraine, over 300 now and likely to be more before this war is over. Not only killing and injuring healthcare workers and their patients, preventing medical care from being provided by those institutions after these healthcare facilities have been attacked. So this is a profound war crime, really, and something that's getting greater attention and really needs to be investigated. And people need, armies need to be, and individual soldiers need to be held accountable for these attacks.
You also remind us that war itself leads to more different forms of violence. I had never really thought about this, but it makes such sense, unfortunately, that even intimate partner violence, gang warfare, once violence, this was profound, once violence begins, it can spread.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me mention three things. One is that during war, many arms are pumped into the war zones. And so after the war is over, there are more weapons, including small arms, handguns and so forth, that are in the population. So the first thing. Second is that many soldiers return home with a so-called battlefield mentality. Disputes get settled by violence, domestic disputes, disputes among neighbors, community disputes, etc. So those are a couple of things. A third thing is that it's been increasingly recognized that violence spreads in some ways just like communicable diseases spread. a colleague of mine named Gary Slutkin, after returning from East Africa, where he worked for many years on infectious diseases, came back to Chicago many years ago and noticed that the patterns of community violence in Chicago, if you plotted them out epidemiologically by time and place and so forth, that the patterns looked very much like the patterns of spread of cholera in East Africa. And so he actually began investigating that more, and he found out a very interesting thing, is that not only are the patterns of spread, the patterns of transmission of violence, similar to the patterns of infectious disease transmission, but that you could use public health principles that are used in preventing the spread of infectious diseases to help prevent the spread of violence. And so among the things, he set up an organization called Cure Violence Global, which actually puts violence interrupters into communities, just like public health officials put in communicable disease interrupters, like vaccine programs, into communities to prevent the spread of measles, let's say. Another important thing to think about is how can we prevent war? How can we use epidemiology and other public health principles to find ways to resolve disputes nonviolently? How can we use public health approaches to go figuratively upstream to look at the root causes of war, such as socioeconomic inequities, poor governance, environmental stress, militarism, ethnic and religious animosity? So how can we look at the underlying causes of war, and what can we do in a positive sense to build the infrastructure for peace? After a war is over, rehabilitating nations, just like we rehabilitate people after injuries, how can we as a global society, through UN agencies for bilateral aid and so forth, rehabilitate nations, reintegrate people back to their home communities, establish in some cases what are called truth and reconciliation commissions? How can we strengthen civil society and promote the rule of law? And how can we ensure citizen participation in the decisions that affect their lives, the government decisions that affect their lives? Very important, by the way, in building the infrastructure for peace is involving women. It's often the men who make the war. It's the women who are vital to making and preserving the peace, and we need to remember that.
I'm going to take you a long way around here, but you say that there's no public health practice at the federal, state, or local level in the U.S. that focuses on the health impacts of war. And yet, again, we are a large player in the global society. And we, again, spend a lot of money on defense and weaponry. And we see the sophistication and the impacts of our weaponry, even in the hands of the good guys in Ukraine. But having said that, I mean, you remind us that military hospitals and the VA are the only times we focus on it, and yet we bemoan how well they perform, and we keep talking about trying to make them better with our own soldiers coming back and not getting the care they need. And I want to add one other thing, because you are a public health expert. I mean, here we are thinking about this war in Ukraine, perhaps not as much about others, but we haven't talked a whit, I don't think, in this country about the million people who have been lost to the pandemic and what we're going to do to make that better going forward. I mean, America has a way of just moving on and kind of shutting its eyes to what just happened without really dealing with what you talk about, these upstream effects. What can we do to make certain that the next time we have a pandemic, not only essential workers who often are low income and low socioeconomic and racial minorities are not affected in the way that they were during this pandemic?
Yeah, well, you raised several issues there. Let me say that in a general sense, I think public health, that is people who are trained in public health institutions, academic institutions, government agencies, non-governmental organizations, need to become more engaged in reassessing what has gone wrong in, what led to the, not only the pandemic itself, but the fact that the United States, I think on a per capita basis, has more deaths related to the, over a million deaths related to COVID-19, more than any other country, at least in terms of rates. And so I think we need to take a look at, reassess what worked, but what did not work, not only in the initial development of the COVID-19 pandemic, but why were we not more effective as a nation in preventing its spread and providing more effective care to the people who were affected? I think we need to take more of a public health approach as a nation to looking at COVID, but also looking at war and how can we, as a world leader, use public health approaches to preventing war, making sure that the victims of current and previous wars get the attention that they need. But what else can we do to promote peace going forward?
I would be remiss if I didn't talk about Chapter 13 in your book, describing environmental impacts of war, including contamination of air, water, land, emission of greenhouse gases, which causes climate change, other damage. I mean, I can't even imagine what's going on in Ukraine to desecrate their natural environment. I know that we leave behind so much of this material that can later cause such damage to individuals who come upon it, not knowing what's there. I mean, just talk about that briefly.
Sure, and you summarize it probably better than I can, but contamination of air, water, and land, air contaminated by fires and explosions. In some wars, these burn pit emissions where the military burns a whole range of things. The greenhouse gas emissions from intensive use of fossil fuels, contamination of water and soil from factories that are destroyed, munitions and so forth, the landmines that have been deployed and the unexploded ordnance in Ukraine and elsewhere, of course, that poses risks sometimes for many, many years afterwards, the potential contamination of land and water with radioactive materials from the war in Ukraine, and in addition to the natural environment, the built environment with homes and workplaces and schools and shopping centers destroyed. I mean, it's unfathomable the degree of destruction. But you're absolutely right. The impact of war on the environment is often overlooked. Obviously, we're appropriately right now focusing on civilians and the needs of civilians and protecting civilians and so forth. But the environment is a very important part of the damage caused by war. The one other thing I want to introduce in the conversation is nuclear weapons. The whole issue of nuclear weapons has come to the fore, of course, in the war in Ukraine. Let's hope and intend that they not be used. But there are 13,000 nuclear weapons, most of which are much more powerful than the weapons used against Hiroshima and Nagasaki 75 years ago at the end of World War II. You know, the use of even one or two of these nuclear weapons could lead to rapid escalation. Even a small nuclear war could affect global temperatures, and that could lead to what some people have called a nuclear winter with famine, crop damage and famines on a widespread basis. And so if anything else, the war in Ukraine has raised attention to the perils of nuclear weapons and the fact that we really need as a global community to do something to totally eliminate nuclear weapons. We've been very lucky. There have been a number of near misses where nuclear war might have started between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and now Russia. We've been very, very fortunate that we haven't had an accidental use of a nuclear weapon or the eruption of a nuclear war, in the 75 years since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We really need to eliminate nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I think we've taken our eye off of that ball. And in fact, when some of these nuclear plants have been close to being hit in Ukraine, or we were worried about that, that sent shockwaves. Let me ask you in closing, this may be a difficult question to answer, but Americans, we have seen so little other than our own damage of the Civil War on our property, other than Pearl Harbor, because of our geographic location. Do you think that changes our perspective as opposed to Europeans who have been trampled by their neighbors time and again, where you can't tell whether, you were Lithuanian or whether you're Russian or whatever, because, it changed in terms of the boundaries so often and by violent conflict? What do you think that does to the American psyche when most of what you're talking about here we have known and sensed, but yet even today we don't have a draft, so we only have those who really volunteer go in and work somewhat removed from the impacts. I doubt anybody was thinking about the soldiers left in Afghanistan until the very end when we saw the chaotic leaving of Afghanistan. What does that do for our society in terms of trying to really understand some of these issues?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it really isolates Americans from the impacts of war that are going on throughout the world, the war in Ukraine has placed the health and other consequences of war front and center before the American public, seeing 24/7 how war adversely impacts human beings in terms of our health, our well-being, human rights, the environment, and our lives in each and every way imaginable. And so that's actually one of the reasons why I wrote this book in the first place, is to try to awaken Americans to the profound, unimaginable in some ways, consequences of war, and what can be done to protect civilians, aid the victims of war, and most importantly, to prevent war and to promote peace.
Well, it's a really important book, and I am so grateful that you have spent some time with us today here on America Trends. Dr. Barry Levy, From Horror to Hope, Recognizing and Preventing the Health Impacts of War. If you have a way to get this book in the hands of a book club or others to really talk about how profound these effects are, it would really be a great service to those who are listening. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's a pleasure being with you.